Hello and welcome to The Right to be Heard, the Columbia Law Review podcast. We're really excited to bring this podcast back with a new look and a new name. I'm Jafar Kalfani Bey, your host for today's episode. Thank you everyone for listening. I'm joined today by Aliza Schatzman of the Legal Accountability Project, a nonprofit focused on increasing transparency in the judiciary and improving clerkship experiences for law clerks. Aliza had a piece published in the Columbia Law Review in May of this year titled The Clerkship Whisper Network: What It Is, Why It's Broken, and How to Fix It. We're so grateful to have Aliza joined us for today for our first episode of the 2023-2024 school year. Good morning, Aliza. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Thank you so much for joining us. We can probably just hop right in. Obviously, as I mentioned, we have you join us today because you have this piece published in our journal called The Clerkship Whisper Network. Could you tell us a little bit about why you wrote this piece?
Sure. So this piece, the title is a play on words of the event that I did with my nonprofit last year with the Office of Judicial Clerkships and Student Senate. I think the event was titled something like The Clerkship's Whisper Network, What It Is, Whether It's Broken, and How to Improve the Clerkship Experience for Every Student and Alumnus. And so during that event, we talked a little bit about what the Clerkship's Whisper Network is, but I felt like there were some things left unsaid that I wanted to write about. But I think it's important to kind of back up and talk about why I wrote the piece more generally. So I went to WashU Law. I graduated in 2019. I aspired to be a homicide prosecutor. So I decided to clerk in DC Superior Court, the jurisdiction where I wanted to practice law. And the messaging around clerkships at my law school, like probably your law school, like at all law schools, was just uniformly positive around clerkships. I was told that I would develop this lifelong mentor-mentee relationship with the judge for whom I clerked, that this position was going to confer only professional benefits. So I was advised to apply broadly, meaning across the U.S. and across the political spectrum, and to accept the first clerkship I was offered. So I did all those things. So I started clerking in August 2019, and unfortunately, things went downhill really quickly. The judge for whom I clerked began to harass me and discriminate against me because of my gender. He would kick me out of the courtroom and tell me that I made him uncomfortable and that he just felt more comfortable with my male co-clerk. He told me I was bossy, aggressive, and that I had personality issues, stuff that you would never say about a male. Day I found out that I passed the bar exam, so obviously, big day in my life. He calls me into his chambers, gets in my face, and says, "You're bossy." And I know bossy because my wife is bossy. This was obviously really devastating. This was my first job at a law school. This judge was singling me out for mistreatment. I wanted to be reassigned to a different judge. My workplace did not have an employee dispute resolution plan in place that might have enabled me to be reassigned. And I knew that I needed a year of work experience to be eligible for my dream job at the U.S. Attorney's Office. I confided in some attorney mentors who advised me to stick it out, and so I tried. So we transitioned to remote work in March 2020. I moved back to Philadelphia to stay with my parents, worked remotely. The judge basically ignored me for 6 weeks before he called me up in late April of 2020, told me that he was firing me because I made him uncomfortable and lacked respect for him, but he didn't want to get into it. Then he hung up on me. So I tried to use the accountability channels that were available to me. I reached out to HR. They told me there was nothing they could do. HR doesn't regulate judges. Judges and law clerks have a unique relationship. Then they told me I should have known I was an at-will employee. So then I reached out to my law school, to WashU Law, seeking advice and support. And that's when I found out this judge had a history of harassing his clerks, the law school administrators, including the clerkship's director and several professors, knew about back when I accepted this clerkship. They decided not to share that with me because they wanted another student to clerk. This is obviously all really devastating. It took me a year to get back on my feet. I applied for jobs, but questions were asked about why the clerkship had ended early, why the judge wasn't listed as a reference. So summer of 2021, I accept my dream job in the DC U.S. Attorney's Office. Move back to DC, intending to put this behind me. And I was 2 weeks into training at the USAO. I'd already started working there when I received some really devastating news that altered the course of my life. I was told the judge had made negative statements about me during my background investigation, that I wouldn't be able to obtain a security clearance, and that my job offer was being revoked. I remember crying on the phone with USAO leadership, DC Courts leadership, trying to explain the situation, find out what was said. They wouldn't tell me what the judge had said, and they told me the decision was final. So I filed a judicial complaint with the DC Commission on Judicial Disabilities and Tenure, hired attorneys, and in the summer and fall of 2021, participated in the investigation into the now former judge. Partway through the investigation, I found out he was on administrative leave. They were investigating him for other misconduct at the time he had filed that negative reference. The USAO was not alerted to those circumstances. He was removed from the bench for other reasons that fall. And then in January 2022, pursuant to the terms of our private settlement agreement, the former judge issued a clarifying statement to the USAO addressing some but not all of his outrageous claims about me. But by then, the damage had obviously been done. I was pretty much blackballed from what I thought was my dream job. And I now share this experience a lot in legal scholarship, on law school campuses. I've shared this with CLS students a couple times now. And I always seek to underscore that my negative clerkship experience is not rare, but it's one that's rarely shared publicly due to the culture of silence and fear surrounding the judiciary, one of deifying judges and disbelieving law clerks. And how this leads to the article and the nonprofit. During the summer, when I was going through the judicial misconduct investigation, I became aware that law clerks are exempt from Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. Folks like me cannot sue our harassers and seek damages, which is outrageous. So I reached out to House and Senate offices involved with drafting the Judiciary Accountability Act. That is legislation that would extend Title VII to the judiciary, to advocate for the bill, to share my experience. And in March 2022, I submitted written testimony for a House Judiciary Subcommittee hearing in support of that legislation. And then in the weeks following, it began to throw around some ideas to further my advocacy work on behalf of clerks, leading me to have conversations with several dozen law school deans and clerkship directors about resources they use to help guide students toward beneficial clerkships, help them avoid judges who mistreat their clerks. Found out there was a real lack of transparent and candid information out there. And that's what spurred the nonprofit and the article.
Wow. That's incredibly tragic. And we're very sorry to hear that that happened, but grateful that you're telling this story that so that other people can know about your experience. After that experience, Aliza, do you have any desire to go back and work in like a sort of more traditional legal job, or has that kind of completely gone away after everything?
So I do field this question from time to time. I have no desire to practice law again. And I think when I first launched the nonprofit and was spending a lot of time, I still spend a lot of time speaking with law students, I wanted to be careful because I didn't want to seem like I was dissuading anybody from clerking. I wasn't dissuading anybody from practicing law. The legal profession from the clerkship system on up is really broken. And I like where I am right now, kind of critiquing systems where I can while working within the structures to make them better. I think there are probably places like a U.S. attorney's office where they might not really want me to work, even though I make clear that I'm not criticizing the judiciary. I couldn't speak freely the way I do now if I were working in a traditional legal job. And that's really sad. And that's one of the cultural changes I'm trying to make in the legal profession, is to make it so you can speak candidly about the full range of workplace conduct and still work in a traditional setting. But for me, I'm happy doing what I do now. No desire to practice law. But I do maintain my bar license because I worked hard for that.
Understandable. And I think I agree with you that it definitely says a lot about these systems that they simply don't want individuals who will be outspoken about some of the flaws of those systems to be sort of members of them, it definitely says a lot about some of these systems we have in place. But I think this is a nice place to transition into talking a little bit more about the nonprofit that you created, the Legal Accountability Project. Could you tell us a little bit about what the nonprofit does?
Sure. So the Legal Accountability Project I launched in June 2022 to correct injustices I personally experienced as a law student and law clerk. A lack of transparency in the clerkship application process that causes way too many new attorneys to enter unsafe work environments because they lack information about judges. A lack of diversity in the clerkship applicant pool, judicial chambers, and legal profession generally. And a really outrageous lack of accountability for judges who mistreat their clerks. We use advocacy, thought leadership, and innovative legal technology to increase transparency, diversity, and accountability in clerkships, the judiciary, and really all facets of the legal profession where attorneys are working and ultimately leading. Our goal is to ensure that as many law clerks as possible have a positive clerkship experience while extending a variety of support and resources to the ones who don't. Our major initiative this year is a centralized clerkships database, legal tech that democratizes information about judges, ensuring that students have more information about more judges before they make the enormously consequential decision about clerking. I speak often with law students and I'll say, okay, so you want a clerk, fantastic. How will you get information about judges before applying? And not just Googling them to figure out which president appointed them, not just surface level stuff, but really, what is the judge like as a manager? What is the clerkship experience like? And what about the chamber's culture? And spoiler alert, whether you go to a T5, a regional school, somewhere in between, there is a troubling lack of information about judges accessible to students right now. And that's what we're trying to solve for. So we have created a post-clerkship survey that asks a variety of questions you might want to know before clerking. This is modeled off what a handful of law schools, primarily in the T14, sort of do already. Except that we ask better questions intended to elucidate candid information about clerking. We are sending out our post-clerkship survey to law clerks across the country right now. And at this point, I committed that we would launch this initiative once we had 1,000 survey responses. 5 months into collecting these surveys, we are more than halfway to that goal. We are the largest independent repository of clerkship information. We have surpassed many law schools' internal databases in size and certainly in breadth and candor of information. And when this initiative goes live this school year, if your law school participates, you as a student or an alum considering a clerkship can log into our database and read thousands of post-clerkship surveys about thousands of judges getting candid information you need before clerking, helping you to identify a good fit and a beneficial clerkship experience. This initiative benefits everybody, students, clerks, law schools, judges, but it particularly is going to help historically marginalized groups, defining diversity very broadly to include not just gender, gender identity, race, ethnicity, but political, law school, socioeconomic, first gen, disability status, veteran status, who disproportionately lack the formal networks and information channels that right now are the primary mechanism for helping students get clerkships. When we think about improving and diversifying the legal profession, it starts fundamentally with improving and diversifying clerkships. Because today's law clerks are tomorrow's prosecutors, public defenders, big law partners, law professors, judges themselves. And the profession and clerkships right now, overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly male, prioritizing the hiring of former clerks. The only way to increase diversity in the profession is to diversify clerkships. So that is basically what we do. And we are launching this initiative this school year. This is my baby. This is my vision that I've seen through. And it's just been incredible to see the database built and to see people filling out our survey and sharing their candid clerkship experience. As you and I are going to get into, there is a lack of information sharing, and there is certainly a lack of candid information sharing right now.
That sounds really exciting. I think as someone who's looking to apply to clerkships this year, really excited to know that there are resources like this out there that hopefully I'll be able to tap into. I feel like I want to know a little bit, obviously, you know, like you mentioned, the piece itself is motivated by your experience in part and other issues as well. I think traditionally we think about law clerks as a sort of privileged group in themselves. You know, not many people are in a position to go to law school, and even fewer in a position to clerk once they finish. So I don't know if you could speak, if you feel comfortable speaking to kind of why we prioritize, or why you and your initiatives have been prioritizing law clerks as a group over others.
I think that the lack of accountability in the judiciary and the lack of protections for law clerks are one of the most urgent issues facing the profession. The lack of Title VII protections is an urgent civil rights issue. The legal community places an enormous premium on judicial clerkships. They offer an enormous salary bonus to law firm associates who spend a year or two clerking. If you look at government job postings, they typically require 1 year work experience, which is a euphemism for a clerkship expectation. Yet they're overwhelmingly white, they're overwhelmingly male, and we don't provide much information about clerkships to students. The messaging is really just everybody should clerk, you should accept the first clerkship you are offered. Yet law clerks play consequential roles in the judiciary and the legal profession. Law clerks have a lot of power in helping their judges make decisions, crafting orders and opinions that affect individual litigants, livelihoods, and liberty, helping literally make and interpret law. And when the law clerk population does not represent the lived experience of the U.S., that is a problem for fairness in judicial decision-making. It's also a problem for the clerks themselves, because as we talked about, today's law clerks are tomorrow's legal everything. Prosecutors, PDs, law firm associates, professors, judges themselves. And this, when we have judges mistreating their clerks and modeling that this is acceptable behavior, we are saying to the next generation of attorneys that this is okay. It is okay to mistreat people. It is okay to discriminate. And then I think a lot about the law clerks who are mistreated, who either go into their next job as less enthusiastic attorneys or leave the profession entirely. And that is a problem because we miss out on the valuable contributions from former clerks who depart the profession or do something else because they were mistreated. Workplace mistreatment, I cannot underscore this enough, has such a huge implication on attorneys' relationships with their law degree and with the law. It certainly colored how I think about the legal profession, of course, how I think about my own law school experience.
Yeah, I think that makes a ton of sense. It definitely seems like there is a sort of gap between the attention we put into getting a clerkship and the attention that we put into making sure that the clerkship experience is positive or, like you mentioned, the right one for us. I think I want to turn now to talking a little bit more about the substance of your piece. Could you tell us about the Clerkship Whisper Network, kind of what it is, what makes it up?
Sure. So unlike many other legal jobs where there are ways for you to get information about what your boss is going to be like, what are the expectations of the job, and what do people think of doing the job, there is no similar type of information sharing for judicial clerkships. The Clerkships Whisper Network is not a term I coined, but it is one I use a lot to describe the backdoor, secretive, fear-infused method of partial information sharing, whereby people with information about judges, particularly ones who mistreat their clerks, that is former clerks, law professors, clerkship directors, and deans, may or may not share candidly with the students, the clerkship applicants who need it. People whisper about mistreatment. And there are several levels to this. There is the fact that the information about these judges in the Whisper Network is centralized in the T5, in the T14, meaning a lot of people do not live in the type of rarefied air where they can even get any information about clerkships. There are information gaps between law schools and even among students at the same law school. And there's a more nefarious failure to share information when it is negative, whereby those with information about judges who harass their clerks either do not share it with applicants, whitewash it, selectively share it. So I spend a lot of time speaking with law clerks, current and former, who reach out to LAP to talk about their negative or nuanced clerkship experience. And they tell me frequently that when law students reach out seeking information about their judges, they don't respond. Sometimes they even remove themselves from the list of law clerk emails that their clerkship director and deans have access to. This is because the legal profession has told former clerks you should fear reputational harm or retaliation in the legal community or by judges for saying anything negative about a judge, so don't do that. But they also don't want to steer any students toward the judges who mistreated them. So we're just going through a few of the ways that the information about judges does not get to the students who need it. And the legal profession kind of perceives that this clerkships whisper network benefits a few clerkship directors and deans in the T14, benefits a few judges who mistreat their clerks. But I want to be very clear, this does not benefit a single student. Whether you are diverse in some way or you are a white male, whether you go to a T5 or a regional school, it harms every student, every clerkship applicant, that information about judges is not readily accessible.
Wow. That's powerful. What role do you think law professors specifically play in this network?
I love this question. I don't get to talk about this enough. When I talk about law school's role in the problems and the solutions, I'm typically talking about the clerkship director and deans who are advising students on clerkships. But whether it is the formal faculty clerkships committee at a law school or the informal professor advising, students routinely reach out to their professors for advice on clerkships. Sometimes they will provide them with a judge list and seek feedback. Sometimes they're asking about individual judges. And then alums who don't report back to their law school's clerkship director and deans about a clerkship experience do more often confide in a law professor. Law professors play a troubling role in gatekeeping information about judges, doing the same things we just talked about, not sharing information, selectively sharing it, whitewashing it. I interface with a lot of law schools, and I understand that some are more skeptical than others, the formal administrations, about the type of information sharing I propose. But law professors shouldn't really have a stake in the game. They should be most interested in ensuring positive clerkship experiences and, you know, law careers for their students. Yet they are not sharing the information about judges who mistreat their clerks with students. And really problematically, far too many law professors message that even a, quote, challenging clerkship, a euphemism for mistreatment, is worth it for the prestige. And I think some of them perceive that they had a negative experience, but they benefited, so they think it's not a problem that should be fixed. Some of them believe that they went through mistreatment, they kept their heads down and endured it, so others should too. Some don't want to sully their judges' reputations. Some don't want to know or at least make it known that they have been sending students to clerkships with notorious harassers. But I hear from too many law professors going on and on about their wonderful clerkship experiences with these really historic judges who are notorious harassers, who law schools have flagged for me, who law clerks have flagged for me. I just got an email like that this week, so that's why I'm thinking about it, but it happens far too often. There is a troubling amount of revisionist thinking and whitewashing and selective information sharing. And I think every law professor needs to recognize their role in the problem and the solution, just like every law school clerkship director and dean should as well.
Absolutely. I think another part of it too may be there are these professors, I think, at many schools who lots of students know are sort of a touch person in terms of getting a clerkship. And I think many of my classmates could probably attest to this. Like, students know this and sort of go out of their way to take those professors' courses, even to the extent that the course is not interesting to them, or maybe that the professor is otherwise difficult, because they know that sort of getting FaceTime with this professor will help them get just a sort of help them tap into that network. And I think that also creates a sort of maybe toxic environment in those courses and surrounding those faculty members, because so many students are competing for FaceTime and attempting to get sort of like, you know, access to that network and getting a clerkship that I don't even know if they maybe would want otherwise, just like sort of any clerkship that they can get, because that person sort of has access to that network.
I'm glad you brought that up. That's something you and I have talked about before. It's so important, because only some people are going to get access to those right professors. And it's disproportionately the well-connected students who do. And I think the most problematic is when, candidly, it is a faculty member gatekeeping the clerkship information.
Speaking on information and sort of the disparity, what do you think about sort of the information disparities between law schools, or even among students at the same law school? How do you sort of feel that that factors into the work that you're doing?
Yeah. So this is the lack of information for students is not at all tied to law schools' rankings, to their clerkship resources. And I often caution for people thinking about where they want to go to law school who want a clerk, that you should, it is not necessarily the law schools that send the most clerks, period, who care the most about whether the experience is positive. So there is more information in the T5, there's more information in the T14 about judges than there is in the law school population generally. But even among students at the same law school, there are information disparities. And there is a prioritization at some law schools among the top of the class in terms of encouraging people to clerk, sharing clerkship information that is problematic. What LAP is trying to do is correct informational asymmetries between law schools, but even among students within the same law school, so that the information is no longer siloed off. I often say to law schools, no law school has a monopoly on information about judges. Nobody knows about all the judges, but your law school is going to be restricted in the information they have about judges based on a few things: who law clerk alumni have clerked for in the past, and their willingness to share information with the law school. Two enormous ifs. And even when law school clerkship directors and deans are trying to reach out informally to their network of clerkship advisors to get information about judges, it's incredibly inefficient at best. It's ineffective at worst. When we are missing the information from people whose clerkship experiences were negative or even neutral. And what do I mean by neutral? Our post-clerkship survey at LAP asks two ratings questions in addition to everything it asks about the clerkship experience. Rate the judge as a manager, positive, neutral, or negative, and rate the clerkship experience, positive, neutral, or negative. And what we are seeing is a lot of discrepancy. People who say the clerkship experience was positive, but the judge as a manager is neutral. That is a type of information that right now just simply does not exist for anybody.
Hmm. I think that's really interesting, and I really think it's an important point that the nonprofit is doing work in that area, specifically around the information and tied to the sort of faculty slash the clerkship office on campus. I wonder if you have any thoughts on the informational disparities caused by student groups. I know I'm sure you come across this in your work, but like certain groups that many students know about have kind of huge informational disparity and access based on their sort of membership in this group. And oftentimes, as many of us know, results in sort of off-schedule clerkships that they land. Is there any plan or any thought as to how your organization can combat things like that? Or is that sort of just outside of the purview of your abilities at the moment?
So we think that centralizing and democratizing this information is going to benefit every student. Whether you are conservative or liberal, whether you are a member of one of the well-resourced student groups or not, you correctly point out that there are informational asymmetries among the student groups. But I would counter, because I've spoken with a lot of those student groups, that nobody has the type of candid information that LAP is elucidating. Some have basic information about, you know, interview experiences, basic information about judges. But the same issues that LAP sees with the formal clerkship advising on law school campuses exist with the student groups. And that is, there is a fear of sharing your candid clerkship experience in the internal network of your law school, because you are either identified, either you have to attach your name to whatever you've written, or you are identifiable because your law school has sent two clerks to that judge over the past 10 years. The benefit of LAP's national centralized information sharing and the option to submit a survey anonymously after LAP verifies who you are and that you clerked is that people will share more information more freely. And so we think that the information benefits everybody in this way. Recognizing some student groups have more information than others, but I would counter, nobody has enough information.
I think you're probably right. I would push back a bit, and I would say that if I was a student in FedSoc and I had access to a circuit clerkship outside of schedule, I don't agree with obviously the informational disparity. And I agree with you that they're probably not fully understanding what that judge is like or the sort of full terms of the clerkship, but I think they may prefer to have that access because it does seem like it would be maybe a bit simpler. But I think that your point still stands.
So without making a statement about FedSoc, because LAP is apolitical and I am as well, I worry just as much about a FedSoc 1L accepting an off-plan clerkship as I do about somebody going through as a 2L the Oscar process. Why? Because while FedSoc has a network of judges to whom they connect with students, they do not have the type of candid information that LAP offers. And I worry about anybody accepting a clerkship without information about judges as managers and clerkship experiences. And there is even more pressure as an off-plan 1L to simply accept the first clerkship you are offered without taking a hard look at chamber's culture and the judge as a manager, and without the benefit of your law school's 2L clerkship advising. So I don't think there's any benefit to simply funneling any type of student into clerkships without taking a hard look on chamber's culture.
I think that's really interesting. I think not many people would think that sort of a main purpose of your organization includes that, right? Includes grabbing those students who also get prestigious clerkships, but are sort of in a different way. So I think that's really important to put out there. Thank you for that answer.
Of course. I think that workplace mistreatment affects everybody, whether you are conservative or liberal. And when we think about judges who mistreat their clerks, from the most progressive to the most conservative, there are issues with workplace mistreatment. It's about encouraging everybody to find a beneficial clerkship experience, regardless of political affiliation. Because today's clerks are tomorrow's progressive and conservative thinkers and leaders. And improving the clerkship system really benefits the entire profession and judiciary.
Thank you. So we talked about this a bit earlier, but I want to talk a little bit about how marginalized groups fare under the current system and how they would fare better under a more transparent system. Could you talk a little bit about that again?
Sure. So historically marginalized groups, and that is women, non-white, first-gen, disabled, LGBTQ students, disproportionately lack some of the formal networks and information channels that help their peers get clerkships. Now, part of that is what law schools are doing. They are picking out the top students to give all the support to in terms of clerkship advising and less advising for the ones who probably need it most. There's also a professor role in clerkship advising, connecting judges with students they perceive will be good fits as clerks. And because many of those professors are white and male, and many of the judges are white and male, the students they think are good fits are going to be white and male too. Law clerks are overwhelmingly white and overwhelmingly male. The most recent NALP statistic was that 79% of federal law clerks were white in 2019, 72% of state court clerks. Diverse students with diversity defined, as we talked about earlier, very broadly, have unique considerations when deciding whether and where to clerk. Now, some of them come into law school with a deficit, not knowing how to get a clerkship and why they should do one. And unfortunately, those deficits widen throughout law school. They have unique considerations, like whether the judge is sensitive to diverse identities, whether the judge hires diverse clerks. Now, that type of information is just not shared. Law schools don't even really have it. They don't have a good historical record of the judge's previous clerks. And yet, these students are particularly interested in being treated fairly and respectfully throughout the clerkship process. Because as we talk about workplace mistreatment, while I certainly encounter judges mistreating white male clerks, I certainly encounter female judges mistreating all their clerks, it is disproportionately the diverse clerks who face the brunt of mistreatment in chambers. And we need to be assuring them that they will be treated with fairness and respect. I really think that transparency is the missing piece in conversations about diversity as well as clerkship advising. And so while LAP's transparency work is going to benefit everybody, it's certainly going to improve the experience for diverse clerks. I also wanted to point out that in terms of people who are first gen, who come into law school perhaps with a deficit in what they know about clerkships, perhaps they also have socioeconomic considerations about the post-law school job market, they're in even less of a position to say no if they are offered this shiny, prestigious clerkship. And that is particularly troubling to me, considering the dearth of information we give to them before they accept this prestigious first job. And then they are also in a worse off position to say no to workplace mistreatment if they are discriminated against. Because the considerations, whether you are a law student, a law clerk, or an attorney, are not to speak out in the face of mistreatment, to keep your head down and stay silent and just move on.
Absolutely. I've spoken to a lot of first-gen students like myself who I asked, like, are you interested in a clerkship? And they're like, yes, I don't really know what it is or how they work or how to apply, but I'm kind of interested. And I think if I didn't come to learn more from reading your piece and other sources about these clerkships and I went into one, I would probably think the same thing, that this is just how they work. And if the judge is mistreating me, that's just kind of a part of how it all works. And I'm not supposed to tell anyone about it. So I think that point you make is spot on.
See, I should have asked you, turn the question around. How do you as a student, as a first-gen student, get information about judges and clerkships?
I've gotten my information pretty much entirely from classmates. Just including what a clerkship is, why it's important as someone who's an aspiring litigator, information about judges themselves. Pretty exclusively. I think as you start sort of go through law school, you begin to develop other sources of information from faculty. If you do externships from potentially judges and law clerks themselves, but I think your initial source of information usually comes from other students. I learned a large amount of my background knowledge for clerkships during like orientation before one out.
I'm glad you brought it back to the faculty piece because there's something I forgot to mention earlier. When faculty are connecting students with judges and they are advising, some faculty members really believe that they have all the information they need about judges. unless they clerked for that judge, they cannot, underscore cannot, speak to the experience of chambers culture and being a law clerk. The only people who can speak to students well about the clerkship experience are former clerks. That's why whether you're getting your information from students, from faculty, from any source that is not the law clerks themselves, it is insufficient.
Yeah, agreed. And a lot of my classmates are currently getting clerkships now, and they're like, I've heard some stuff about the judge, but I don't know too much. Or some of the clerks will tell me some things, but other things they won't tell me just because it's not commonplace to tell. But that's I think so jarring, right? These are people who have who were interviewing with the judge and have now secured clerkships. And before they secured the clerkship, they were having a difficult time getting that information from these judges. So it's just incredibly difficult. And I think you highlight a good point.
And one thing I worry about this, because I hear this too much from students who've accepted a clerkship, is they will say, I've heard mixed things about this judge, but it won't, workplace mistreatment won't happen to me, or I can handle it. I hear that a lot. I can handle it. Well, first of all, you shouldn't have to. And as my experience illustrates, there's no guarantee that you will. I tried to stick it out, and the judge who mistreated me then destroyed my career. So there is no guarantee that a judge won't stop mistreating you when the clerkship has ended. I speak with too many former clerks whose judges gave negative references after the clerkship had ended. And I want to talk about the experience of being mistreated, because you're probably not going to do your best work if the judge is yelling at you. And you're probably not going to seem like a good fit and a good clerk if you were being mistreated. That's probably going to infuse your work. That's going to affect how the judge thinks about you and what they write and say about you when asked to be a reference. So that's why it's so important that we, on the front end, ensure beneficial clerkship experiences and stop the cycle of mistreatment, which really starts with sharing candid information about judges as managers. For anybody who is not sharing their experience with mistreatment, you're perpetuating a negative cycle of abuse. And I know that's hard for some people to hear, especially those who kept their heads down and stayed silent, but it's on everybody to be part of the solution.
In terms of how recommendations go once you've clerked, right? Like every legal job you have, if they see your resume and see that you've clerked, they may call your former, advisor, your former supervisor at a firm, or various individuals in your other positions, but they're definitely going to call your judge, right? Could you speak to that a little bit?
Definitely, yes. Some professors at LAP's law school events last year were making this point. So whether you list the judge as a reference or not, 5-10 years down the road, they'll still be contacted about you. And so the fear for law clerks who've been mistreated and why they often don't say anything negative about a judge is that there is this more kind of insidious retaliation or giving of a lukewarm reference. So a judge is contacted and they just say, oh, Aliza was fine. Aliza was okay. Well, when there are 200, aspiring prosecutors competing for the job, that's just a reason to toss you. Because right now, legal employers are enormously incentivized to take a judge's reference as the word of God, to accept it unquestioningly, and they should stop doing that. I did not realize, and perhaps I was just stupid, the enormous power that a judge would exert over my career after the clerkship had ended. And if I understood that, I might have made a different decision. And I think it's important that students understand that now. This is an enormously consequential first job, whether state or federal, whether district or appellate. You are clerking for one of the most powerful members of our profession. And the way that goes for you, your workplace experience, is going to have enormous consequences throughout your legal career. So it's important to be mindful about who you clerk for, and law students just cannot be right now.
I think that many understand that a better or a more transparent system is probably better. But what would you say to law school clerkship advisors or deans of clerkships who don't want their students' chances of clerking to be affected by them buying into a system like this? What kind of advice would you give them to those individuals?
So this is one of my favorite questions. We have no evidence that any judges are going to blackball any law schools for participating in this database. But I would say this. I would say a couple things. Any judge who would oppose transparency, any judge who thinks that their workplace conduct should not be subject to scrutiny, is not somebody law school should send students to clerk for, is not someone students should aspire to clerk for. It should be a red flag if any judge is out there opposing this. And let me talk about why the database benefits judges. It's going to help judges get more and better applicants, expanding their pool of candidates, particularly to include more diverse students. Most judges just want to hire the best candidate, period. So the idea that they would foreclose an entire law school, particularly a prestigious one, is ridiculous and a totally unfounded concern. Many judges view this clerkships database as a recruiting tool for themselves and their courthouses. We're going to give lots of judges the opportunity to be spotlighted for their roles as managers and mentors. And most judges perceive that they're going to be reviewed positively, so they have no problem encouraging law schools that they hire from and where they attended to participate, encouraging their former clerks to fill out the survey. I want to reiterate, it should be a red flag if any judge opposes transparency. It's not somebody law schools should send students to clerk for. It's not somebody you should want to clerk for.
I think that's a really good point. And I think that one other benefit of the database for judges is that the students who apply to specific judges now have more access to information. And so they're probably more interested based on that information if they're still applying for that judge. So I think the judges are also getting clerks who are more willing to buy in to their whole management system because they're familiar.
Definitely. And not every clerk is a good fit with every judge. Not every law student is a good fit with every judge. But there's just no way for students or judges to make informed employment or hiring decisions right now. And nobody wants someone who doesn't work well with their management style, but there's just no way to know most of this information right now. It's going to benefit everybody.
So you talk a lot about what law students can do, what sort of faculty at law schools can do. Could you tell us about what law students and listeners can do right now to help increase diversity, transparency, and accountability in the clerkship system?
Yeah. So right now, LAP is working with many law schools to encourage them to participate in our clerkships database. We think this is the best way to democratize information about judges, improve the clerkship experience for everyone. If you are a law student, you should urge your law school to participate. You should meet with the clerkship director and deans and explain why this initiative would be valuable right now. You can circulate a petition or sign-on letter. You can host an LAP event this school year, and we can talk about the benefits of this initiative. Law students demanding change are going to power this movement. And I've been impressed with a lot of student advocacy on many campuses, but it's important to know that students are the customers here. They are the ones who are harmed by the status quo. They are the ones who will benefit from this database. It, of course, helps clerkship directors and deans by giving them more information too. But this is a student-centric initiative, and demanding change needs to come from the students.
I noticed that on your website, there's a fee for students who would like to participate or who would like to have access to the database. Could you talk about why you charge a fee, how much, and why the service is justified given the fee?
Good question. So it is a subscription fee for law schools. So we are asking law schools to pay $5 per student per year based on total JD enrollment to give all students and young alums up to 5 years post-grad and older alums on a case-by-case basis access to the clerkships database. The smallest schools, the fee is around $3,500. The largest might be $8,000 for schools with a huge JD program. We are doing legal tech. building and maintaining it in a way that is safe and secure. And this was obviously expensive to build. We want the clerkships database to live on in perpetuity so that the money LAP raises can go toward other initiatives. Law schools and law students generally understand that this data is incredibly valuable and well worth the price. We likely will have individual student subscribers who will be charged more than $5 per student per year because it is less cost efficient to do the business model that way. We think law schools should pay to subscribe for a couple reasons. We think there are logistical, monetary, and moral reasons. Logistically, we want them to send out our post-clerkship survey. We want them to market the database to students. It is easier for them with their enormous list of law clerk alumni to send out the survey. It is easier for them to market it to their list of law students. Monetary. A couple thousand dollars, candidly, is a drop in the bucket for most law schools. Any fee is not one we want to charge for individual law students. This is a service your law school should provide for you. You pay to attend law school. They push you into clerkships. There is clerkship advising. It is insufficient. This is a way to improve the clerkship advising. But then the third aspect is a moral reason. And look, law schools don't love me saying this, but I will say it again anyway. Law schools have historically been part of the problem. Sending students into clerkships they know or suspect are bad to increase public perception of the law school and their clerkship numbers, period, with little regard for what the clerkship experience will be like. They should be the first to step forward and make changes, and that includes monetary changes to show that they believe in the importance of a positive clerkship experience. So that's how we think through the subscription fee and why we think law schools should pay to subscribe. And that is why the student advocacy here is so important. If you as a student believe this would be valuable, tell your law school why they should pay to subscribe.
Thank you. I'm really glad you cleared that up. I initially think I misread and thought that the students pay, but that sounds like a much better option to have the law school pay the fee for the students.
See, I agree with you. That's why we're charging the law schools and not the students.
Right.
But the downside of that, and so I work hard at my relationship with every single law school's clerkship director and deans. Now, I critique systems in the legal profession without criticizing anyone personally. There are some challenging law schools that really perceive me as criticizing them personally. And while that was not my intent, the clerkship system is broken. And anybody refusing to engage is really part of the problem. So we're going to go another year of clerkship advising and clerkship applications where, unfortunately, some law students are going to go another year without these type of transparency resources because their law schools won't engage. That is unfortunate. That is why we will open it up to individual student subscribers. But at this point, there is really no good reason why a law school shouldn't want to do this. We've been at this for over a year, answering questions, demoing the database. Now we're at that critical juncture where the database is here. The post-clerkship surveys are in it. And we are going to launch, whether we have a handful of law schools on board or a ton. But it'll be easier for this to succeed more quickly if more law schools step forward and say, yeah, it's time to make some changes.
Thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate having you on. If there are listeners who want to get in contact with you, Aliza, how can they reach you?
Yeah, so our website is legalaccountabilityproject.org. You can sign up for our mailing list. You can email me, aliza.schatzman@legalaccountabilityproject.org, and I am also very active on social media. And I'll be visiting more law school campuses this year, including an event at CLS in November.
Thank you so much. Is there anything else you wanted to say before we close out?
You know, these issues that we're talking about today affect everybody, whether you clerked or plan to clerk or not, whether you appear before judges in your practice or not. Law clerks play an integral role in the functioning of our judiciary, and the lack of protections for them is outrageous. The lack of accountability for judges who mistreat their clerks has implications for the future of our profession, has implications for judicial decision-making. LAP's work starts with law clerks, but it benefits everybody, the judiciary and society generally.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on the show.